Penrod looked up at the stark black cliffs that rose on each side of them. They were barren as ash heaps from the pit of hell. As they moved into the gut of the defile, the cliffs compressed and deformed their formations, but no gaps appeared in the sides of the square. Carefully, Penrod scanned the cliffs. There was no sign of life, but he knew this was an illusion. He glanced across at Jakob. "Osman Atalan is here," he said. "Yes, Abedan Rigi," Jakob smiled, and his right eye rolled out of kilter. "He is here. There is the sweet perfume of death in the air." He drew a deep breath. "I love it even more than the smell of fresh quimmy." Only you, lascivious and bloodthirsty Jakob, could combine love and battle in the same thought. But, Effendi, they are one and the same. They moved on down the narrow defile. Fear and excitement coursed like intoxicating wine through Penrod's veins. He looked around at the bluff, honest faces that surrounded him and was proud to ride in their company. The quiet orders and responses were given in the familiar accents of home, so diverse that they might have been different languages. The sounds of the Scottish Highlands and the West Country, of Wales and the Emerald Isle, of York and Kent, of the Geordies, the Cockney, and the elegant drawl of Eton and Harrow. "They will be waiting for us on the far side of this pass," Jakob said. "Osman and Salida will want to work their cavalry in the open ground." "Salida is the emir of your tribe, so you understand his mind well," said Penrod. "He was my emir, and I rode in his raiding parties with him and ate at his fire, until the day his eldest son ravished my little sister, and I took the dagger to them both, for it was she who enticed him. Now there is blood between me and Salida. If he does not kill me first, one day I will kill him." "Ah, patient and vengeful Jakob, this may be that day." They rode on through the narrow neck of the pass, and the sides opened like the jaws of a monster on each side of them. Still there was no sign of life on the dead, seared hills, not a bird or a gazelle. The bugle sounded the halt, and the distorted square came to a jerky stop. The sergeants rode down the ranks to redress them. "Close up on the right. Keep your spacing in the ranks. Wheel into line on the left." Within minutes, the integrity of the square was restored. The corners were at meticulous right angles, and the spacings were precise. The lines of bayonets glittered in the relentless sunlight, and the faces of the waiting men were ruddy with sweat, but not one unhooked a water bottle from his webbing. In this thirsty wilderness, to drink without orders was a court-martial offence. From the back of his camel, Penrod surveyed the ground ahead. Beyond the funnel of hills, it opened into a broad, level plain. The earth was carpeted with white quartz pebbles and studded with low, sun-blackened salt scrub. At the far end of this bleak expanse stood a tiny clump of palm trees that seemed to have fossilized with age. "Good cavalry country," Penrod thought, and turned his full attention back to the trap of the hills on either side. Still they were devoid of all life, yet seemed charged with menace. They quivered in the heat mirage, like hunting hounds brought up short by the scent of the quarry, waiting only the slip to send them away in full tongue. The cliffs were riven by gullies and wadi mouths, by rocky salients and deep re-entrants. Some were choked with rock and scree, others coated with sand, like the floor of a bullring. Jakob giggled softly and indicated the nearest of these with the point of his camel goad. There was no need for him to speak. The tracks of 1,000 horses dimpled the surface of the sand. They were so fresh that the edge of each hoofprint was crisply defined, and the low angle of the sun defined it with bold blue shadow. Penrod raised his eyes to the serrated tops of the hills. They were sharp as the fangs of an ancient crocodile against the eggshell blue sky. Then something moved among the rocks, and Penrod's eye pounced upon it. It was a tiny speck, and the movement was no more striking than that of a flea crawling in the belly fur of a black cat. He brought his small telescope out of the leather saddlebag and focused on it, then saw the head of a single man peering down on them. He wore a black turban, and his beard was black, blending well with the rock around him. It was too far to recognize his features, but the man turned his head, perhaps to give an order to those behind him. Another head appeared beside his, then another, until the skyline was lined with human heads, like beads on a string. Penrod lowered the glass and opened his mouth to shout a warning, but at that moment the air throbbed with the gut-jarring beat of the dervish war drums. The echoes rebounded off the facing cliffs, and now the host of the Mahdi appeared, with miraculous suddenness, upon all the ledges, galleries, and crests of the pass. The central figure stood clear upon the utmost pinnacle. His jibba sparkled white in the sun, and his turban was dark emerald green. He lifted his rifle with one hand and pointed it at the sky. The grey gun smoke spurted high into the air like the breath of a breaching sperm whale, and the sound of the gunshot followed seconds later. A mighty shout went up from the serried dervish ranks. La ilaha illa, there is but one God. The echoes shouted back, God, God, God. The bugle in the centre of the British square sang on a wild, urgent note, and the troops reacted with smooth, practiced precision. Down went the camels, kneeling in orderly lines, forming at once the outer ramparts of this living fortress. The baggage animals and their handlers moved back and crouched in a dense mass in the centre. They were the inner keep. Swiftly the gunners unloaded the Nordenfeldt machine guns from the pack camels and staggered with them to the four corners, from where they could lay down enfilading fire along the front of each wall of the square. General Stuart and his staff stood in a group just within the front wall. The runners knelt close at hand, ready to race to any corner of the square with the general's orders. A deadly silence fell upon this assembly of warriors. The dervish ranks stared down upon them, and time seemed frozen. Then a single dervish horseman rode out from the stony mouth of the main wadi. At extreme rifle range, he stopped, facing the square. He raised the curve ivory war clarion, the ombeya, and its clear, deep voice resounded along the cliff. From the mouth of every wadi and coombe poured the dervish host, rank upon rank, thousand upon thousand, camels and horses. They kept coming, wheeling into loose squadrons, facing the little square. Few men were dressed or armed in the same way. Lance and spear, axe and round leather targe, rifle, jezil, and the dreadful broadsword were poised. The drums started again, a slow, rhythmic beat, and the dervish ranks started forward. "Wait for 'em, lads," the sergeant strolled down behind the front wall of the square. "Hold your fire, boys. No hurry. There's enough for everybody." The voices were calm, almost jocular. The drums beat faster, and the dervish lines broke into a trot, the Ansar in the front beginning to jostle each other to be the first into the square. Faster still, and the dense, savage masses seemed to fill the valley floor. Drums crescendoed and hooves thundered. The dust rose in a choking miasma. The war cries were shrill. "Steady, boys! Steady!" Calm English voices responding to the pagan shrieks. "Hold your fire, chaps," Penrod recognised Percy Stapleton's clear, boyish voice as he called to his platoon. He was having great difficulty restraining his eagerness. "Steady, the blues!" "The scamp thinks it's a boat race," Penrod smiled to himself. The drums pounded feverishly, and the ombeyas squealed and sobbed. Like the flood from a burst dam, the dervish cavalry came straight at the British square. "Get ready! Rolling volleys, lads!" called the sergeants. "By the book now, my boys. Remember your drills. Rolling volleys! Make each shot tell!" Penrod was watching a shake on a rangy ginger camel. He had forced his way well ahead of the front rank of the charge. His mouth was wide open as he screamed, and there was a black gap in the line of his front teeth. He was 100 yards from the face of the square, then 70, then 50, and coming on at a wild gallop. The bugle rang out sweet and high. "Rolling volleys! Front rank! Fire!" There was that brief pause, characteristic of highly trained troops, as each man steadied his aim. Penrod picked out the gap-toothed shake. The volley crashed out, astonishing the ear. The front rank of the charge shuddered to the shock. Penrod's man took the heavy bullet squarely in the chest and flipped backwards from his high saddle. His camel slewed round and crashed into the two horses coming up behind it, bringing one down heavily. "Second rank! Rolling volleys! Fire!" Again the rifles crashed out. The bullets struck flesh with the sound of wet clay slung against a brick wall. The dervish charge wavered and lost impetus. "Third rank! Rolling volleys!" sang out the sergeants. "Fire!" The bullets churned the dervish into confusion. Riderless animals milled and shied. Bearded warriors swore and struggled to break clear. Corpses and wounded men were trampled and kicked beneath the hooves. At that moment, the Nordenfelts added their spiteful chatter to the uproar. Their fire hosed down the line. Like a barracuda driving through the shoal of pilchards, it split them into small, isolated groups. "Front rank! Rolling volleys! Fire!" The orders were repeated. The troopers reloaded, aimed, and fired with the oiled precision of rows of bobbins on a carding machine. The charge stalled, broke, and the survivors streamed towards the cliffs. But before they reached them, the drums called to them and the ombeyas sang, "Go back! For Allah and the Mahdi, go back into the battle!" Fresh squadrons streamed out from the rocks to swell their depleted ranks. They massed, shouted to God, and came again, tearing across the trampled field where so many of their comrades already lay, charging in to break the British square. But a British square does not break. The sergeants called the timing of those regular rolling volleys. The barrels of the Nordenfelt machine guns began to glow like horseshoes in the blacksmith's forge. Osman Atalan had told Salida, "It is necessary to feed them corpses to stop up their mouths." The Nordenfelts gorged on human flesh, choked on it, and one after another jammed. As their staccato chatter ceased, so the dervish cavalry pressed closer, right onto the thicket of bright bayonets. Still the volleys crashed into them. They struggled forward and were chopped down until even their courage and resolve were exhausted. At last, they shrank away and rode back to the cliffs.